From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. As the conflicts in Beirut have grown more violent, the political and religious motives have become more confusing to most Westerners. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk about how Beirut became a battle zone with Fouad Ajami, who grew up in Beirut and is now the director of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Donald Westlake first became known for his hard-boiled crime fiction. Now he writes comic capers. Today, Westlake tells us why he stopped taking crime seriously. Plus, we have a review of the new jazz album from alto saxophonist Steve Coleman and a look back at how television covered the Democratic Convention. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Fouad Ajami describes Beirut as a city where the veneer of civilization has cracked. Ajami grew up in Beirut in a Shia Muslim family. When he was a teenager, he left Lebanon to study in the United States. He made America his home, but his work has been focused on the Middle East. Ajami directs Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and he's written extensively on the Arab world. Fouad Ajami wrote the text for the new book, Beirut, City of Regrets, which features photographs by Eli Reed. Ajami's essay tells the story of how political catastrophe came to Beirut, how the city became a land of cruelty and hatred, a free-fire zone, a place of kidnappings and car bombings. I asked him if he thought of this essay as a eulogy for the city he grew up in.
I think you have the right word for it. It is in part a eulogy of the city. Here is a city that meant a great deal to not only to the Lebanese, obviously this is their great capital city, but it also meant a great deal to the Arab world. This was a place where the Arab world met Europe, if you will. This was a place where East and West met. I mean, this is a kind of a slogan that people have about Beirut. It's a cliche, but it's very real. And it is one's own. This is the city where I myself grew up in. I was born in the southern part of the country, but like many people from the southern part of the country and the Bekaa Valley in the east, we all converge on the city of Beirut. This was the place where I was schooled. This was the place where I spent my teenage years. And there was something there. If there is such a thing as Arab and Muslim liberalism, and such a thing as the Levant, if you will, in the Arab world, this kind of meeting of East and West, this meeting of Christianity and Islam, to the extent that that world existed, it really existed in Beirut. And it is that world is gone. That world is gone. A poet of Beirut, and the text in the book, The City of Regret, closes with this poet. A poet said, look, nothing remains of old Beirut except the scent of it that blows from old notebooks. So whether Beirut committed suicide or whether Beirut was the victim of homicide, that is, whether others pushed Beirut over the brinks, Israelis, Palestinians, Syrians, Iranians, whatever, whether it's a case of homicide or of suicide, a city and a way of life have really belonged to the past. And it was time, I felt, to write of Beirut and to write of Lebanon, not a political story, but the kind of eulogy that you ask about.
Well, since Beirut, what's happening in Beirut now is so confusing to most Americans, I thought it might be good to try to see the city through your eyes as someone who's both lived there and studied it as well. Now, you moved to Beirut from the countryside of Lebanon when you were around 3 or 4 years old. Right. Why did your family want to move to Beirut?
Well, you see, I think in many ways the politics of Lebanon and the life of Lebanon became the life of an extended city-state. I mean, Beirut, this was the magnet. This was the countryside of Lebanon was being emptied of any economic life. Lebanon was really a poor country. The land was a very poor land. And you saw in Lebanon what you saw in many third world societies, that the city became the great magnet. The city became a place where people could sustain a dream. And in the case of my family, they were tobacco growers. They were really impoverished gentry. A man who came to Lebanon once said about that many of the Lebanese came from royal ancestry and personal destitution, that they were all very proud of their ancestry, but it was also a very poor land. So my family came to Beirut in the mid to late 40s. Other people were making the journey. People from the Bekaa Valley, close to Syria in the east, were making the journey. People from the northern part of the country were making a journey. And at some point in time, I think maybe even more than half the people of Lebanon lived in the capital city. Again, not so much a uniquely Lebanese phenomenon, but a widely third world phenomenon. There were no schooling. There was no schooling to speak of in the southern part of the country. And the land was being annulled, economically annulled. It couldn't feed and sustain the people in the hinterland. So we came to Beirut. And, you know, it was the old dream that you would find life and you would find sustenance in the city. In the case of my own family, once they made it to Beirut, they also made another typically Lebanese decision. They went far away out of Lebanon. Some of the men, and even in time, some of the women, my aunts, my father, they left to West Africa and to Saudi Arabia and to other places to make money, and the children remained behind. And so there was always this sense that you make your stand in Beirut, and this was where Lebanon converged.
Now, you grew up in a Shia neighborhood.
Yes.
Your family were Shiite. Yes. Shiite Muslims.
Yes, I grew up in a neighborhood which you know is gone now. Which I in my memory of Beirut and my fantasy and one's own childhood becomes such a precious inheritance. This was an Armenian Shia neighborhood. The Armenians who had been driven out by the Turks from their country had come to Lebanon and had claimed a piece of swampland on the outskirts of the city, in the northeastern part of Beirut, a poor part of the city, and made their home there. So when the Shia of Lebanon came from the Bekaa Valley and came from the southern part of the country, when they arrived in Beirut, they were unable to move to West Beirut, to the Muslim part of Beirut, to the bourgeois, if you will, middle-class part of Beirut. So they moved in with the Armenians. And in this part of Beirut, there were Armenian refugees, Palestinian refugees, Shia who came from the hinterland of the country, Syrians who came to Beirut. There was something to it. I mean, there was something vibrant and wild about this place. It was poor, but there was a tremendous sense of cultural diversity to it. I knew the Armenians very well. I mean, this was the first foreign world, if you will, that I was introduced to.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. Let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Fuad Ajami, and he's the director of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University and the author of many books and articles on his native Lebanon. His latest book is Beirut, City of Regrets. He wrote the text, and there are also photographs by Eli Reed. Now, you write that when you came to Beirut, when you were growing up there, that you really tried to assimilate. And I was wondering what it was you were trying to assimilate to, and what ethnic or religious things you wanted to kind of smooth out to be less noticeable.
Yes, there were many fragments of many worlds in Beirut. I mean, Beirut, there were all sorts of sounds and there were all sorts of cultures there. The elite culture among the Christians was basically what you could call Franco-Arab. The Christians in the eastern part of the city, the Christian elite spoke French. They were dipped in French. T.E. Lawrence, the famous T.E. Lawrence, once said of Beirut that it was bastard French, that there was something of this enormous French culture. Now, on the western part of the city, among the Muslims and among the upper class and middle class Palestinians and the ascendant Muslim classes, the rising Muslim classes, the culture was clearly, the politics was Arab nationalist. The hero of the time was the Egyptian Jamal Abdel Nasser. But there was also a tremendous American presence. This was the presence of the American University in Beirut. So if you grew up in Lebanon, you had a cultural choice to make. Among the Muslims and the Palestinians, the cultural choice was Arab nationalism and then this Anglo-Saxon culture, if you will. This was, you could learn, everyone had to learn Arabic. The issue was, would your second language be English or French? So there was a kind of an American presence. And I suppose that for people who came from the countryside, Shia Muslims, poorer people, there was a dominant elite Lebanese culture that they were trying to plug into. So there were fragments of many worlds, but the culture that counted among the Christians was this French culture. Among the Muslims and the Palestinians was this Anglo-Saxon and then, of course, Arab elite culture.
Well, it sounds like, in a way, what you wanted to cover up almost was being from the country.
Yes, we were exactly, and I don't think it's very unique. I mean, this is a worldwide story. There was the shame of coming from the countryside. In my case, for example, I eventually made it to an American school, an elite American school in Beirut. But to show you this cultural dualism that existed in Lebanon, my mother was a woman of the countryside. She was of gentry peasant background, and she wore a headscarf. She wore a head cover, which deeply embarrassed me in the very, very modern world of Beirut. And there was even something which one now could admit with a touch of guilt. I may have even made a pact with my mother, if I remember, that if she saw me in the modern company that I was keeping, that she stayed away from me. There was something false about the culture of Beirut. There was something of this. There was a prissy quality to it, if you will. There was a precious quality to it and a pretentious quality. This was part of Lebanon, and it was part of the culture of Beirut, no doubt.
When you were growing up, did you sense anything like the divisions that exist now? Now Beirut is a divided city. When you were growing up, what were the divisions like between Muslims and Christians?
Nothing, you're right, nothing like what exists now. I mean, this is really Beirut now. It's a tale of two cities, if you will. There is East Beirut, it's one world. There is West Beirut, it's one world. There is Shia Beirut, there is Muslim-Sunni Beirut. There are many Beiruts. Well, in my time, growing up in the 50s and the 60s there, it wasn't war hadn't broken out. Men hadn't taken up arms to fight one another. But let's not kid ourselves. And I think the Lebanese have come to lie a lot in exile, in retrospect about their city and their country. It was always a place where lines were drawn. Men and women and young men and women always knew and always belonged to one community. The names gave it away. If you ran into a Michelle or a George or a Hannah, this was a Christian. If you ran into a Muhammad or Ali or a Hussein, this was a Muslim. Names gave it away. What's interesting, there were some, and actually this happens to be in my case, there were some names which were secular. Like if your name was Fuad, for example, it was hard to tell whether this was a Christian or a Muslim name. So identities were always flashed, and everyone was their own identity. And in the end, there was a part of Beirut and a part of the world of Beirut on which Muslims and Christians met. But when the day was done, when that interaction was over, after you did business with the Christians and the Muslims, then everyone returned to the cocoon of one's own kinsmen. There was a place, a common ground on which Christians and Muslims met. But I always felt that common ground was false and obviously fragile, as we came to understand later. The Lebanese really lied to themselves. There were things they used to say that, the Muslim crescent, this is the symbol of Islam, the crescent, that the crescent and the cross embraced in Lebanon. There were all sorts of myths that we had, all sorts of things we said about the country. But I think in the end, the religious sect was the dominant way that Lebanese identified themselves. It was a place of minorities, a place of sects. Suffice it to say, the best way of describing it, this was a country of 4,000 square miles and 17 different religious and ethnic communities. Not only were the lines Muslim and Christians, but even among the Muslims, the Muslim faith divided. There were Sunni Muslims and there were Shia Muslims and there were Druze. And among the Christians, there were Catholic Maronites, Greek Orthodox, Protestant, Greek Orthodox Armenians, etc., etc. It was a world of such obvious diversity and clearly deep antagonisms, which people never really publicly expressed.
You moved to the United States when you were a teenager.
Yes.
To study in America. And I'm wondering if when you came here, although there were so many divisions in Beirut, if when you came here you were just seen as someone from the Middle East, a Muslim,
Yes.
whether Americans just totally erased or refused to acknowledge all the differences that you've just enumerated.
Yes, and I think, for the Lebanese in particular, I mean, in terms of one's own experience, the Lebanese always wanted to signal to Westerners, and maybe we all are guilty of it, all people who came from Lebanese background, that yes, we are Arabs, but we're really Lebanese, you see. We're a piece of the West washed on the shores of the Mediterranean. There was this duality to Lebanon's existence. Clearly, it was more westernized than the other Arab countries, and it is something that the Lebanese always wanted to flag in their new habitat.
Well, I want to talk with you more about what's happening in Lebanon now, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Fuad Ajami. He's the Director of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University and has written extensively about Lebanon. His latest book is called Beirut, City of Regrets. He wrote the text. The photographs are by Eli Reed. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Fouad Ajami is my guest, the director of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He grew up in Beirut. Let me ask you, you were just talking about, you know, why you decided to stay in the United States. And I'm wondering if you felt that had you gone back to Beirut, you would have had to be a partisan in the kind of growing conflicts between the different groups, if it's easier to see the big picture when you're outside of the city.
Well, it was, you know, one would like to make one's choice so grand. I think it was just, there was a world here that was open, and there was a world in Lebanon that was closed. There was a world here that was large, and there was a world in Lebanon that was very small. Lebanon was always... The biggest export of Lebanon, one Lebanese once reminded his compatriots, he said, don't be so arrogant about this country. The biggest export of this country are Lebanese people. Wherever you go, in South America, in West Africa, in North America, this has always been a country that drove men away. It banished them to other places. It banished them to other places, and there, in faraway places, the people there remembered how beautiful the land was. They talked of the echo of church bells in the valleys and so on. But there was one reality. It was always a poor land, and it could not sustain people's dreams. And the dreams in the country, and this may even have a large political meaning, the dreams were bigger than the place would sustain. People were so ambitious and so driven, and the ideas about what they wanted for themselves were so grand. But this was a country without much agricultural land, with no industrial potential. It lived off tourists. It lived off Saudis and Kuwaitis and Iraqis who had oil but needed a place to play. They needed nightclubs, and Beirut provided the nightclubs. They needed a place where they could publish books, and Beirut provided this. It was a very small country with a very fragile economy of services and tourism. And all this, of course, now is in the past. I mean, the place has been ruined because there's no economic base to speak of.
You were talking before about how there was at least the image when you were growing up in Beirut of the different Muslim groups and the different Christian groups all communicating with each other on some level.
Yes.
Now, whether that was just image or whether there really was that level of communication,
right,
it's all fallen apart.
Yes,
communication no longer exists. What are the origins of that breakdown, do you think?
Well, you know, I think it was what I call a necessary fiction, a necessary lie. We needed this. We needed to tell, the Lebanese needed to tell one another and to tell themselves that actually Muslim and Christian could exist. And there are really two ways of looking at the Lebanese dilemma and the death of Lebanon, the collapse of Lebanon, and the anarchy of Lebanon of the last 12 to 13 years. You could say, well, why did Lebanon collapse? And maybe there is another way of putting it, a prior way of putting it. How did Lebanon come together? You see, maybe the ingredients were never there. The ingredients were never there for one country. This Republic of Lebanon was put together, I mean, without getting too drawn into ancient history, but this republic was put together by the French in the aftermath of World War I. They added to Mount Lebanon, which had two communities, the Maronite and the Druze. They added to it the city of Beirut, which was essentially a Muslim Sunni city. And they added to it the Bekaa Valley, which they sliced off from Syria, which was predominantly Muslim Shia, and the southern part of the country. So it was always a hodgepodge. The country was drawn, you know, like many, many countries in Afro-Asia, the country was drawn by the colonial masters. It was drawn by the colonial masters. The dominant community in Lebanon, the Catholic Maronites, who were friends of the French, prevailed on the French in the aftermath of World War I, when the entire map of the Middle East was drawn and redrawn. They prevailed on the French to create this, what they call Le Grand Liban, the larger Lebanon, the bigger Lebanon, not just Mount Lebanon in the mountain, but the current borders of the Lebanese state. So from the very beginning, the country bore the seeds of its destruction. There was something there that was very fragile. The communities were of vastly different temperaments and different cultures, of various levels of development. The Christian communities in the mountain were much more developed than the Shia community in the hinterlands. The Muslims of take, for example, the coastal cities of Sidon in the south, Beirut in the middle of the in the heart of the coast, and Tripoli in the north. Take the city of Tripoli, some 50 miles north of Beirut. Now, this city of Tripoli was culturally far more connected to Damascus in Syria, mentally and economically and religiously, than it was to the city of Beirut. So when the map of the modern Arab world was drawn after World War I, this the entity of Lebanon, the modern entity of Lebanon, was from the very beginning a quilt, an impossible quilt of communities.
When you look at the fighting now between Muslims and Christians in Beirut,
yes,
what do you think of the fighting as really being about?
Well, you see, I think that's a wonderful question. I think the Lebanese may themselves not really remember what this is all about. But even take you know, we look at Beirut and we say that there is a war. There is a green line, ironically, a green line that divides Muslim West Beirut from Christian East Beirut. Now, traditionally, we used to think, and for a while, the war was across that green line. The Christians are on one side, the Muslims are on another side. But what's interesting about the place has been further dividing and subdividing. Now, you don't really have war across the green line. You don't have just Muslim killing Christian. Now, the most fierce fighting occurs within these communities. For example, take the Shia, the Muslim Shia, the stepchildren of Islam, if you will, the poorer Lebanese, the Lebanese allies of the Iranian Revolution. Now, most of the passionate Shia fighting and the vicious Shia fighting has taken place between Shia mainstream people, this Amal militia, the mainstream militia of the Shia in Lebanon, and the Party of God, which is sustained by the Iranians and paid by the Iranians. Take the refugee camps, the Palestinian refugee camps. The fighting is not between the Palestinians and the Christians, because the Palestinians really don't run into Christians. It's between proponents of Yasser Arafat, of the PLO, and opponents of Yasser Arafat, and so on. Go over to the eastern part of the city. You don't have now Maronite Christian Catholics fighting Muslims. You have intra-Maronite war. Maronite has been fighting Maronite. It's really a fight over turf. And men have gotten, war has become a way of life. A generation has come into being. Look, this war broke out in Lebanon in 1975. It's now more than 13 years old. Now, if you were 5 or 6 years old when the war broke out, you have only known war as a way of life. Lebanon has redefined the normal. Normal is war. And I think it's a fight. Fighting becomes a way of life. The feud becomes the precious possession. A while ago, there was a vicious war broke out between the Shia underclass in West Beirut and the Palestinian refugee camp dwellers. And they were fighting over shells of gutted buildings. And these shells of gutted buildings were called strategic. There was nothing strategic about them. Men know only war, and they are now, that's the way of life that's open to them.
When you go back to Beirut to visit friends or family, what's the experience like for you, since the city has changed so much from the city that you grew up in?
Well, you know, there came a time when, in a way, the Beirut I knew was gone. For example, the part of Beirut the precious part of Beirut that I was used to myself, this Armenian Shia slum in northeastern part of the city, that now fell behind Christian lines, and the Muslims were expelled from it. And so that part of the city is not even open. My own family, my mother, and parts of, you know, because some of them have left and some are still in Beirut, are in what, you know, what has been euphemistically called Little Tehran, the southern slums of Greater Beirut. And that's a completely different world. So of all the things that existed of that world, the old city that one knew, that's completely in the past.
We have very little time left, but I'm wondering, if the truce between Iran and Iraq holds, what effect do you think that's going to have on Lebanon?
I think it's a good question, and I think there may be even some implications here for the Western hostages, both the American hostages and other hostages who are being held in Beirut. There has been a parody in Lebanon of the Iranian Revolution. Little Tehran, if you will, is there. And in part, some of the passions of Lebanon have been fueled by the Iranians. The Iranians have needed a place where they could hold up to the rest of the Muslim world as an example of an Islamic revolution. It's conceivable, just conceivable, that if the Iranian revolution now admits its defeat, admits its inability to change the politics of the Muslim world, and turns its attention inward, realizes that the last decade was a lost decade, and that the attempt to change the politics of the Muslim world have failed, that they would channel less of their money and less of their fervor to Beirut. And it's conceivable that Beirut, to the extent that you could single out the Iranian part of the agitation, that Iranian influence would be weakened, and that the Lebanese who answer to Iran will discover that they are on their own.
You know, earlier you used the expression that whether you think that the death of Beirut is from homicide or suicide.
Yes.
And I was wondering what you think. Do you think of the demise of the city as being homicide or suicide?
I think a bit of both. You see, I think it was always an unfair city, an unjust city. When the Lebanese, some Lebanese, yearn and grieve for the city, I've always felt that, of course, we're really talking about the pampered classes grieving for a city that the poorer classes don't really remember and never knew. And so whenever you meet people of any, you know, the so-called ancien regime anywhere, people who grieve for an old world, they grieve for something that they themselves knew and treasured and enjoyed. I think it was an unjust city. I think it was an unfair city. I think that there were people who were left out of the country. There were communities that were left out of the power and the resources of the country. And there are people who have no sorrow. There are Lebanese and residents of Beirut who really have no sorrow for the old Beirut. They don't want it back. Maybe they don't want what exists now, the ruin that exists now. But when you tell them of the city, you know, the graceful city by the Mediterranean, the city of nightclubs and the city of culture and so on, they don't remember it. They never knew it. It was not theirs. And there is an irony now that the poor have inherited the ruins of a city. And John Milton once said, you know, there's something very relevant to Beirut, that maybe it's better sometimes to be a master in hell than a servant in paradise, a servant in paradise. And for many of these young Party of God believers, these young militiamen, life is not perfect, but they don't want to go back to the past, for it was not a world that was fair and that was kind to them.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts.
Thank you for giving me a chance.
My guest has been Fuad Ajami, and he's the director of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He grew up in Beirut. He's the author of the new book, Beirut, City of Regrets. It's published by Norton. Ajami wrote the text, and there are also photographs by Eli Reed. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Sid Mead, who describes himself as a visual futurist. He works on a lot of movies. He created the post-apocalyptic landscape for Blade Runner and a world inside a video game for Tron. He also co-designed the Johnny Five robot that can be seen in the new film Short Circuit. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. One of Donald Westlake's earliest published stories was a first-person account of his life as an adulterous housewife. It was a true confession-type story for a pulp magazine. That story was about as truthful as the articles in the tabloid Westlake created as the backdrop for his new novel. Coming up, Donald Westlake talks about his hard-boiled and his comic crime novels. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from alto saxophonist Steve Coleman, who plays funk-influenced jazz. And television critic David Bianculli explains what TV did right at the Democratic National Convention and what it did wrong. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Residents of the disputed Soviet territory Nagorno-Karabakh went back to work today for the first time since a general strike began there in mid-May. Workers were under intense pressure from the Kremlin, which appears to have solved this ethnic crisis with a tough crackdown on the protesters. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Most factories and stores were operating in the territorial capital of Stepanakert, according to residents reached by telephone today. But the official news agency TASS said that after weeks of neglect, it could be days or weeks before many businesses are fully operational. Residents in the predominantly Armenian region said they still object to last week's government decision, rejecting their demand to be united with the Republic of Armenia. But after national authorities threatened to permanently close Stepanakert factories and to file criminal charges against executives at striking businesses, workers decided to end their ethnic rebellion. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
After a four-day push, Iraq says it is withdrawing from the Iranian territory it just seized. In announcing the withdrawal, Iraq repeated its claim the advance was necessary to liberate its own territory and to capture war prisoners to strengthen Iraq's hand in upcoming peace talks with Iran. Iran claims it shot down an Iraqi warplane during the weekend fighting and inflicted heavy Iraqi casualties. United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar said today he expects to announce within 10 days a date for the start of a ceasefire in the Iran-Iraq war. NPR's Margot Adler has the latest.
Iran's Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Velayati arrives in New York today. Iraq's Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz is expected tomorrow. UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar will meet with the foreign ministers separately starting on Wednesday. Questioned on his way to Security Council consultations on an Iranian complaint that Iraq had used chemical weapons during the last week of fighting, the Secretary General said today that he hoped there would be progress in implementing Resolution 598, the Security Council's year-old resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire, the withdrawal of troops to international borders, an exchange of prisoners, and the establishment of a commission to determine responsibility for the conflict. While Iraq has been pushing for direct talks, Perez de Cuellar said today that one had to be realistic, that it was too early for such a meeting, and that it would be better for the Secretary General to initiate the dialogue. I'm Margot Adler in New York.
Burmese leader Nay Win, in power since a 1962 coup, has retired as leader of the ruling party. His request to step down was accepted by the Burma Socialist Program Party, while it rejected his call for a referendum on ending Burma's one-party rule. Nay Win cited bloody anti-government riots this year and his age as factors in his retirement. He's been blamed for leading Burma to economic disaster through isolationist policies. It's not clear when the party will name Nay Win's successor. In India, Sikh extremists have killed the head priest of the Golden Temple, Sikhism's holiest shrine. Police say Sohan Singh and two other officials were fired on by three gunmen who escaped on motorcycles. Singh was appointed head of the temple committee in May after police and troops forced more than 150 Sikh extremists out of the temple. At least 42 Sikh radicals were killed during that siege. No group has yet claimed responsibility for today's attack. Forest fires burning in Yellowstone National Park came within 9 miles today of the Old Faithful geyser. Altogether, fires have burned roughly 40,000 acres of the 2-million-acre park. Park rangers say conditions at the park are drier than they've ever seen, with precipitation 7.5 inches below normal. Stock prices closed mixed in active trading today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 11 points to close at 2071.83. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Alto saxophonist Steve Coleman is a central figure in a group of younger black musicians, mostly based in Brooklyn, New York, who integrate jazz with the funk and rock music they grew up with. Coleman plays straight free bop in bassist Dave Holland's quintet and jazz funk with his own band, Five Elements. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Five Elements isn't his favorite setting for Coleman, but on their new album, they sound better than ever.
Steve Coleman has been a controversial figure ever since his second album came out 2 years ago. His debut record, Motherland Pulse, showcased his agreeably obtuse writing and helped show why he's the most original alto saxophonist of the 1980s. But Coleman's second and third albums, with his loose-knit group Five Elements, attempted a viable mix of jazz and funk with mixed results. The group's new album, Sine Die, on the Pangea label, isn't Coleman's best work, but it is Five Elements' best. Partly that's because the illustrious Marvin Smitty Smith is better than other drummers at giving funk rhythms a jazzy lift. But it's also because Coleman's given more room to the gifted singer Cassandra Wilson. She wrote the lyrics for four Coleman tunes, including Cinema Saga. Cassandra Wilson is on half of Steve Coleman's new album, but not all the material is this strong. A couple of tracks strike me as hardly better than filler. Even so, Coleman, the saxophonist, refuses to play it safe. Where other jazz musicians who flirt with dance rhythms, like Oliver Lake, simplify their styles to try to get in a groove, Steve Coleman brings to jazz funk the same searing sound and oblique approach to harmony he brings to more straight-ahead jazz. Here's the end of his solo on Cinema Saga. Clearly, this is a cut above Grover Washington and Kenny G. Steve Coleman doesn't get hemmed in by funk patterns because his dancing rhythmic sense is self-contained. In a way, his populist funk is like the angular music of avant-garde saxophonist Anthony Braxton. Like Coleman, Braxton comes from Chicago. Both layer intricate melodies over thorny rhythm patterns. Here's Coleman's Circle C with trumpeter Graham Haynes and guitarist David Gilmour. We'll be right back.
problem with this new album by Steve Coleman and Five Elements is that the other players don't always swing as hard or sound as inspired as Coleman himself. Kevin Bruce Harris's electric bass vamps and Gilmour's chicken scratch guitar tend to get monotonous. A musician I know tells me he was talking to Steve Coleman recently and told him how much he'd enjoyed that no-nonsense first album of his, Motherland Pulse. "Yeah," Coleman responded, "I hear that all the time, but the funk records are what I really want to make." "Well, fair enough," this musician replied, "but why can't you make both?" Good question.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Steve Coleman's new album, Sine Die. It's on the Pangea label.
Everybody's got to have a destination. Everybody needs somewhere to go. Everybody's got to have a destination. Everybody needs somewhere to go. Everybody's got to have a destination. Everybody needs somewhere to go. Everybody's got to have a destination.
This is Fresh Air. In the grim world of crime fiction, Donald Westlake is known for his comedy. Although he prefers writing crime novels that are more funny than serious, he wrote the screenplay for the recent psychological thriller The Stepfather. He started off writing straight, hard-boiled stories. His 1962 novel The Hunter, about an emotionless professional criminal named Parker, was made into the movie Point Blank, starring Lee Marvin. Westlake's new novel, Trust Me on This, takes place at a sensationalistic tabloid in Florida called The Weekly Galaxy. I asked Westlake if he ever worked on a newspaper like the one described in his book.
Actually, I met a fellow who had worked for one of them for a year and a half as an editor, and he told me some stories which eventually found their way into the book. And when he told me the stories, I said, well, what's wonderful about it is that it's the front page without the serious content. It's, there is no escaped death row murderer hiding in the desk. There's just chasing the fire engines. And I said that in the first place, that could be amusing. And in the second place, it raises the age-old question of what happens to people who live exclusively on dessert.
Now, I assume that you never wrote for a tabloid, right?
Never.
But you did write confession stories.
Good heavens, yes.
Now, are we talking true confession stories? What kind of confession stories are we talking?
Oh, of course, true confessions. Do they still exist, those magazines?
I think that they do.
Yeah, because they used to be, their format used to be summed up in three words, which was sin, suffer, repent. And they were allegedly true stories, and they were, you know, full of adultery and babies out of wedlock and all told in the first person. And when I was first in New York and working for a literary agent who would get sort of schlock bottom of the market assignments for things, a guy there came over to me at one point and said, "Do you know anything about confession magazines?" And I said, "Oddly enough, I do, because a roommate and I did a content analysis of confession magazines in college, for which we got a B-. And so he said, "Good, you do 3 one-paragraph story outlines, and we send them to this company, and they check off the one they want, and then you write it 3,000 words for $50. And I said, "Terrific." I did the 3 stories that weekend and got $150 and was well on my way.
So you had to write these first person, right?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, yes, weeping at the typewriter.
Now, how did you get from there into hard-boiled detective fiction?
Oh, it was easy. Well, actually, when I began, I wrote everything. I wrote, delicate slice of life stories and sent them to the Swanee Review, and they sent them right back. And I wrote science fiction and even though I was someone who grew up in upstate New York, I wrote westerns, I wrote anything. And ultimately, mystery stories began to get published and began to be liked. And I think there's a natural tendency to go where you're liked. So that's I did more and more of those. And I spent years going around saying I'm really a writer disguised as a mystery writer. But eventually, the evidence piled up all around me. So I guess that's who I am.
Now, I think the first books that you really became known for were the Parker novels written under the pseudonym of Richard Stark. Do you right. want to describe the Parker character?
Well, what I wanted to do was as emotionless a character as I could. He's been described as being amoral, which is true, but was not the point. The point was that he was emotional. He was a criminal because that's the easy way to have a story. But I wanted somebody who would, no matter what happened, take the rational point of view. You know, there's the thing saying that crazy people are only crazy in one spot, and then everything else is sane once you allow for that one change. So I wanted somebody who had no emotional content, and then he would go on from there.
Now, how did you get from writing this hard-boiled fiction about an emotionless character to writing humorous crime fiction?
I think what happened was that I got tired of the conventions of the form. Every form, every genre, in every art, this is the only time I'm going to use that word, has its conventions, has its, you know, its obligatory scenes and its necessary perspectives and so on. And I got tired of the things that have to be done. And after I'd written several books, I started to write another book, and it was an innocent on the run kind of novel. And it began to come out funny. The innocent on the run began to comment on the things that were happening to him in an unseemly fashion. And I told my agent and my editor about it, and they said, oh, gee, don't do that. And I said, well, it won't take long, and I'll do it right the next time, but I seem to have to get this out of my system, and this one's going to come out funny. And it came out funny, and it just kept coming out funny from then on.
Did writing humor give you a chance to, in a way, admit to any absurdity you felt about writing all these tough guy type characters, knowing that you're really not the tough guy type yourself?
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, that's part of it. I say that the essential difference between a fiction writer and a criminal is the level of imagination. That the criminal can imagine committing the crime and can imagine how the crime should be worked out. The fiction writer can imagine committing the crime, can imagine how the crime can be worked out, and can imagine getting caught. So the criminal who can't imagine part number three goes ahead and does it, and the fiction writer who can imagine part number three just writes about it. A much safer way to do it.
So you still sit down to write crime fiction, and it's still funny. I mean, you still have to write it funny?
Yes, usually. I think that by now it's possible for me to treat each story on its own terms, because I know that I can fool around with it if I want, so I don't have to. A couple of times I have not. There was a screenplay I did, a movie that came out last year called The Stepfather, which the intent there was to terrify you, not with a a teenage kind of slasher kind of movie, but with what has always been called psychological suspense, a kind of Hitchcockian thing that hasn't really been treated well for a while. It has its little moments of humor, but its intent was elsewhere.
So, I mean, you're a writer who spent most of your life dreaming up crazy crimes, writing about psychopaths. what kind of connection do you feel to the lives you've dreamed up for your fiction and your screenplays?
Well, I want to set The Stepfather to one side and deal with the comedies, because I think of the comedies as my realism, mm-hmm. or my realistic fiction. When anybody else writes a novel with a bank robbery in it, when the bank robbers get to the bank, there's a parking place in front. Whenever anybody in real life goes to the bank, there isn't a parking place in front. So when my guys go to rob a bank, they have to park three blocks away and walk back. So from that point of view, I think that my books are more realistic than everybody else's, and I think that's really where my discontent with the conventions of the genre took me. They took me into, well, what would it really be like? And as soon as you do what it would really be like, it's funny.
That's great. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Donald Westlake's new book, Trust Me on This, is published by Mysterious Press. Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, tonight we have a report on the region of Nagorno-Karabakh. We've been hearing a lot about that area of the Soviet Union. There's been months of unrest there. Well, a two-month strike is over. Workers have gone back to work, and protest, for the moment at least, is over. Also, in 1990, Japan will have the third largest defense budget in the world. Today, we have a piece on the controversy over pressing Japan to accept a greater share of the burden of protecting the Northwest Pacific. And Michael Palin of Monty Python fame talks to us about his favorite piece of music and also the kind of music that the character he plays in A Fish Called Wanda might like to hear.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In just 3 weeks, the Republican National Convention will get underway in New Orleans, and television will be there to cover it. TV critic David Bianculli says there are some lessons to be learned from the coverage of last week's Democratic Convention in Atlanta.
You want to know what still bugs me and thrills me about last week's TV coverage of the Democratic National Convention? Come to think of it, you probably don't. The convention receives saturation coverage to the point of absurdity, and by now the whole thing's a memory. There are some memories, though, that I just can't shake. The one that still gets me mad when I think about it was something that happened on CBS moments before Michael Dukakis took the stage to deliver his nationwide speech last Thursday. It was bad enough that CBS had decided not to televise Olympia Dukakis' introductory speech or the biographical film about her cousin Michael. Both Olympia and the film were shown by ABC, NBC, CNN, and C-SPAN. But then, literally as Dukakis is taking the stage, CBS's Diane Sawyer gets herself into ambush position to, as she put it, see if we can get a question in. Now here's Dukakis, a guy who's seconds away from making the most important speech of his life, a guy for whom public speaking doesn't exactly come easily, and Diane Sawyer is trying to break his concentration to get the answer to her question, which she's had the whole convention to think about and polish and hone to perfection. So what was the question? Governor Dukakis, she screamed as he passed in front of her. How's it going? Dukakis, to his credit, didn't answer or even look her way. Maybe he had something more important on his mind. I have some nicer memories from last week, though, including some from the ghosts of conventions past. The C-SPAN cable network got a head start on the convention by replaying highlight specials from previous televised Democratic conventions going all the way back to 1948. It was absolutely wonderful to watch.
And I want to thank you for your courtesy, for your indulgence, and from the bottom of a grateful heart, express to you the hope that you'll use only one measuring stick when you select your nominee, and that is select the man that you believe is best for your country.
LBJ!
And if you select him...
Let me just say that I appreciate what Senator Johnson had to say. He made some general references to perhaps the shortcomings of other presidential candidates, but as he was not specific, I assume he was talking about some of the other candidates and not about me.
Watching those highlights put last week's convention and its major issues and players in a much clearer perspective. For all these years, for example, I've been carrying around in my head the image of Bobby Kennedy standing at the podium the year after his brother's death and being unable to begin his speech because of the ovation that seemed to go on forever. Well, I saw it in its entirety last week on C-SPAN, and that ovation lasted 14 minutes. In TV, that is forever. And seeing it fresh made me even more emotional when, at the 1988 convention, John F. Kennedy Jr. received a shorter but equally moving welcome. And with Dukakis deliberately evoking the spirit and Democratic presidents of the 60s, seeing those spirits in their prime was more than just an exercise in nostalgia. With television, repeating history isn't something we're doomed to do. It's something we should do. And C-SPAN did it perfectly.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. This is how John Chancellor sounded from the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago.
Police are now in the aisles here with billy clubs, clearing people out. They're not using them on people, they're carrying them, and they're dragging everybody right out of the aisle here. It's a terrific crush. About one, two, three, four, five, six policemen came in here, some of them wearing the blue helmets of the Chicago Police Force, and they are dragging out of here the people who were involved in this.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with writer Mary Gaitskill, critics have praised her first collection of short stories for her portrayals of emotional and sexual violation that leave her characters unable to connect with the love or affection they strive for. Also, rock historian Ed Ward plays songs from the Rolling Stones record collection. Ed says that what brought Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Brian Jones together was their shared love of American rhythm and blues singers. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.